Hi, welcome to this week's program. Before I get started with today's commentary, I want to mention that last week, a listener wrote in with some strong feelings about comments I had made on the previous week's show regarding the seriousness of the COVID-19 virus. She's a doctor, and she felt that we didn't take the virus seriously enough, actually imparting information that might be dangerous to listeners. As I re-listened to the segment, I agreed with her that we might have been too cavalier in our comments at the time and not taken it as seriously as we should. Now, by way of explanation, not excuse, all of our interviews are actually pre-recorded, and occasionally events evolve faster than we can get to air. This sometimes makes our facts and comments out of date, and in this particular point in time, events did roll out at warp speed. In this case, I don't think we made that distinction, and I want to make sure that you all treat this deadly virus seriously, understanding that the facts strongly indicate a serious risk to life, and we should be following the specific guidelines from respected medical authorities. You know, I always encourage you to contact us and ask us any question, and this also includes your well-expressed thoughts on anything that you think we can do better. All right, now getting on to today's comments. Here's some interesting facts. Do you know where the word quarantine comes from? Well, according to the CDC, and I quote, "The practice of quarantine as we know it began during the 14th century in an effort to protect coastal cities from plague epidemics. Ships arriving in Venice from infected ports were required to sit at anchor for 40 days before landing. This practice, called quarantine, was derived from the Italian words 40 giorni, which means 40 days. Also, Leonardo da Vinci survived a series of bubonic plagues that struck Milan between 1484 and 1485, killing almost 50,000 people, a full third of the city's population. In true da Vinci form, he got to work designing a city of the future to counteract the conditions which caused the plague to spread so lethally. A few years later, he redesigned the streets of Milan by widening them, the purpose being to spread people out so they weren't so crowded, and to redirect water to clean up the filthy conditions found in Milan and other medieval cities at the time. He drew up a system of canals for business efficiency and sanitation. He even created a city built on multiple levels, each level used for a different purpose. Of course, with so many things that da Vinci designed, it was too radical and far ahead of its time. After all, this was 500 years ago, so nothing was ever built. But as with so many of his ideas, modern thinking puts a fresh light on his genius. Now I'm going to switch gears here because I'd like to spend some time talking about the $2.2 trillion bill, which was passed by the Senate but awaiting a House vote as I record this. I'm sure it'll be passed by the time you hear it. This bill will give most Americans money into their pocket. Here are the facts as written by the Washington Post. The bill will provide $1,200 payments to adults with annual incomes up to $75,000, plus another $500 per child. Three kids, that means another $1,500. So who qualifies? Individuals earning up to $75,000 a year will be eligible for the full $1,200 check. As you make more money, that $1,200 is reduced until it goes to zero at $99,000. And this is all based on adjusted gross income. If you're married, married couples just double it. They'll get $2,400 if their income is under $150,000 a year. As with individuals, the check amount is reduced until you get to $198,000 when it hits zero. If you're a head of household, which is typically a single parent with children, you'll get $1,200 if your income is $112,500 and below. The sliding scale reduces your payment until you earn $136,500 when it goes to zero. All three groups will get an additional $500 per child. So how does the government know where to send the money? They'll know where to find you if you have provided direct deposit information on your 2018 or 2019 return. If you don't have a direct deposit option on your return, the government will mail the check to you. When will they arrive? Well, the last time this happened was in 2008. Checks took around 8 weeks to get into your mailbox. The government is currently saying they'll get them out sooner, like by April 6th, but many think that's too ambitious. What about if you're on Social Security? People on Social Security will get the money too, as long as their income isn't above the limit. Even if you don't file a tax return, the government will credit the account your monthly payment goes into. Now, are the checks taxable? The checks are not taxable income. However, according to the Washington Post article, the payment will be based on your 2020 income. Since no one has filed for 2020, they will go back to 2018 or 2019 and compare what they paid you against your actual 2020 income. This means you may owe them money when the dust settles if you were overpaid, and that bill will come due in 2021. So that's today's market commentary, but I want to remind you to join me on a free call-in event where I will discuss a lot of questions you have been asking. Questions like what to do if the market keeps going down and stays down, how to boost your return on savings, how to reduce your taxes, how to increase your cash flow, how to secure a steadily rising income from investments and savings. Also, if bad market conditions continue, will you have enough money to retire, or will your savings be enough in retirement? And also, techniques to stay calm and carry on. So join me 12 noon, Thursday, April 9th. Go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up and get the call-in information. That's Thursday, April 9th at 12 noon. Go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. With everything going on, I'm putting together shows that will hopefully bring some light and insight that you can use during this difficult time. As we're all spending time inside, I thought you might enjoy insight into writing a novel from the author of Black Mass and how to become a TED speaker through the art of storytelling. Stuck at home with the kids? I've included a segment on how to teach your kids to become successful entrepreneurs to hopefully boost ideas on projects you can do. So, have a listen, enjoy the show, and above all, stay safe. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Dick Lehr is a professor of journalism at Boston University, as well as a reporter at the Boston Globe, where he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in investigative reporting. He was a longtime member of the newspaper's investigative reporting unit, the Spotlight Team, which was highlighted in the movie Black Mass about the Boston crime boss Whitey Bulger and was made into a film starring Johnny Depp. And today we're going to talk about his novel, Trell, based on the story of a drive-by gang-related shooting death of 12-year-old Tiffany Moore in 1988 and the daughter of the wrongly accused convicted man who persuaded a reporter and a lawyer to help her prove her father's innocence. Dick Lehr, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So give us a brief synopsis of the story. Let's take it from there.
Sure. Well, this is a novel largely aimed at young adults, and the protagonist, the main character, is a 14-year-old girl from the Roxbury neighborhood in Boston who's grown up with her father, her daddy, in prison for a murder that occurred when she was a newborn baby girl. And she's marked time by going to the prison, visiting her dad, and always asking daddy when you're coming home. Well, the main action of the novel is she's 14 now, and all the legal appeals have been exhausted that they've worked with a lawyer, and the lawyer's thrown up her arms and hands and said, all I can think is if we can get a journalist, a reporter, to poke around into here and maybe uncover some new evidence, that's all I can think of. And so Trell, this young girl who's really determined to help her dad get home, figures out who the best reporter at the Boston Globe is, and she overcomes his initial resistance, I'm not interested in this and whatnot, and they partner up. And over the course of the main action of the plot, the two of them are a team, an investigative team, so to speak, and they work the streets of Boston trying to develop the evidence to show that her father was wrongfully convicted in a murder.
So this is a novel and based on a true story, so kind of break down the difference between the two here.
Yeah, well, I call it my scaffolding. Years ago, one of my last stories I did for the Globe was to investigate a wrongful conviction case involving a man who was in prison for a murder. Obviously, he didn't commit as a result of the investigation. Mm-hmm. And he did when he was first arrested in the late 80s. He had a newborn baby girl. and it was a notorious case in Boston at the time, I used that as scaffolding, as infrastructure to take off and to develop the story around this girl, Trowell, who's, you know, a young teenager. So it's largely fictionalized, but it's inspired by this true case that I had worked on when I was a reporter at the Boston Globe.
Now, when you were writing that story and when you were at the Boston Globe, the family was poor, urban, couldn't afford a high-priced lawyer.
Yep.
And, you know, so this is a show about money. This is a show about economics. You know, to what degree did the economic system prevent these families from kind of getting fair trials?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things about this, you know, to me, it's a realistic, you know, novel, drama, reality-based kind of thing. And one of the things between the lines is that you do have this family that's struggling in the city. They don't have the resources to hire a high-powered, high-priced, fancy law firm to defend, you know, his name is Romero Taylor, when he's first arrested and picked up off the streets. When he's convicted originally, you know, in the backstory of the novel, his lawyer, you know, was a drunk. You know, he was just a public defender who was, you know, useless to him.
Yeah.
So it kind of captures the systemic inequalities and the economics that can come into play in the court system. Fast forward to, you know, when their trial is working on the case, again, they still can't hire a big-time lawyer, but they do have a lawyer, someone fresh out of law school, who's a bulldog. And, you know, they got lucky that way.
Mm-hmm.
It was her first appellate case and whatnot, but, you know, she's doing her best, but she's a rookie.
Now, in this book, the protagonist, Trowell, is determined to better herself and to break out of the Boston school system and the, I guess, the cycle of poverty and despair. And so how do you characterize that?
Yeah, what I do, and that's part of developing her traits, and she's also a runner, a long-distance runner. I mean, all these things are the theme of a marathon. Trying to prove her father's innocence is a marathon, you know, investigative journalism. And also that she's determined to do better and to get ahead. Well, on her own, she got herself into an exclusive private school outside of Boston. And her family's really proud of her that she, you know, showed that kind of gumption and initiative. Again, one of the secondary storylines is that her first year there, she hated it. She was the proverbial fish out of water. She didn't know what to say to people. You know, classmates are talking about their parents going to Yale and Harvard, and she'd turn around and go the other way because if someone asked her, her dad's in prison in Walpole, maximum security prison.
Right.
So she's really struggling with that kind of economic disparity. And then even the kind of token, you know, progressive liberalism of some of the teachers who are making assumptions about, you know, she's late to school and assuming that there's all these kind of wild parties going on at her home. And so it shows someone struggling with those kinds of disparities and whatnot.
She's mingling with people who live in mansions and have drivers.
Chauffeur-driven cars,
and there's no doubt that she must have felt totally, you know, not accepted or kind of worthy in that situation. I mean, what would keep a person like that focused on the long term, especially at that age?
Well, one of her main decisions while she's working with the reporter that summer on her dad's case is she doesn't want to go back, and she's got to make up her mind whether to go back because she did feel so defeated by it. But there was one lifeline. There was, in the English class, an English teacher started to get through to her with some poetry and whatnot. So there is a little ray of hope there. But that's one of the, you know, the decisions that's pending that she's struggling with and whether or not to go back. And the reporter, the relationship that she develops with this older reporter from the Boston Globe, his experience, he had apparently, you know, I mean, he went to private school in his back story and he got thrown out. So he starts to, they talk a little bit about that and how it can be a good thing. You can make it work for you. You know, so those are the kinds of dialogues they have.
You know, it's interesting how one person or one or two people in a young person's life can really make all the difference.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've experienced myself on that. So you worked with the Spotlight team, which, as I mentioned in the intro, was characterized or highlighted in that film starring Johnny Depp about Whitey Bulger. What was it like to work there?
Oh, I mean, it was something I always aspired to. I grew up in Connecticut, and the Globe was, you know, my dream place to work as a journalist. And at the Hartford Courant, I had gotten into investigative reporting, so the Spotlight team was, you know, where the action is. It's a real luxury and a public service to be part of a unit that doesn't have a daily deadline.
Yeah.
The mission is to go deep and go wide, and let's uncover, develop things that our readership, our audience, ought to know about in terms of perhaps corruption or systemic failure. And, you know, it's a long-standing, you know, it's an institution at the Globe, and despite the struggles of newspapers everywhere, the Globe has kept its commitment to the Spotlight team.
Well, you know, we're going through a period of time in our own history where the quality of news is questioned. You know, we've heard this term fake news all the time. Actually, I'm going to be doing a commentary on fake economic news, how to tell the difference between the two. What are your thoughts these days about the quality of journalism, and how do we protect ourselves as lay readers? How do we know the difference?
Well, I mean, the quality is all over the map. I think the key is, and, you know, I teach journalism now at BU, and I think it's almost like everyone has to develop, in some ways, their own journalism muscle in order to approach everything that's coming at us. And as we consume information, some of it accurate, a lot of it not, that we be skeptical and be trained, as journalists are trained, is to test information, you know, not believe everything we see or hear, but develop strategies to go sideways and to verify. And it may sound exciting, it may feed into something I want to believe, but hold on. There's just so much chaos out there.
Well, you know, I know how to go to the gym and develop a muscle. I know how to do that. And but I don't know how to develop a journalism muscle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can see if you're in the business, you know, you can double check and check and all that. Anything come to mind as some quick clues as to what you can do?
I know that there are engineers trying to develop apps that would help consumers.
Yeah.
People have talked to me about that. And I certainly have read about educators trying to find ways to embed early on in elementary and the middle school years into the curriculum, this ability to test and be the skepticism. I mean, I think that's all good. It's not going to happen overnight. And I think we've missed a lot of folks. But I think, you know, there's some hope there. To loop it back to Trell for a second, I mean, one of the things I think it makes it timely, too, is that Trell and teams up with a journalist. And this whole investigation and everything that they do to try to prove her father's innocence is about journalism. And one of my big messages or takeaways, hopefully for a younger audience, is the role of journalism, is the power of journalism in our world, in our democracy. That's something that's near and dear to my heart. Yeah. So that's a big part of Trell.
I definitely don't want to take that for granted. Unfortunately, Dick, we are out of time. You know, to hear this interview again or to listen to the full show or to get a summary of the vital lessons learned here today, go to stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update, and we'll send you important lessons from the show straight to your inbox on a weekly basis, telling you what's going on, what we've talked about, and something that I think you'll benefit from. Dick Lehr, thank you very much for joining us. It was a great help.
You're welcome, Steve. Good to talk to you.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. J.J. Ramberg is host of MSNBC's Your Business, which appears weekends at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and she's co-founder of GoodShop.com. Now, I've asked her here today because I discovered a new book she has written called The Startup Club, which is a book for kids about entrepreneurship or starting a business. And I think it's something every child will want to read. So I thought it'd be a good thing to talk about today. Hey, JJ, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I like that intro. Every child will want to read.
I think so.
I agree.
I do. So what drove you to write a book for children about entrepreneurship?
I have three kids. They are 7, 8, and one of them just turned 10 this week. And they're entrepreneurs, right? All kids are, right? Lemonade stands and dog walking businesses and slime businesses. And so I wanted to go to the bookstore and find a book that had characters that were starting a business, not a nonfiction. I wanted a fiction book because my kids love reading fiction with characters they could be inspired by. And I just couldn't find one. I couldn't find a recent one. And so I called my sister up and a good friend of ours who's a children's book writer and said, we should write one. There's a real opportunity here to teach kids some stuff while also giving them a book that they really enjoy reading.
Yeah, some characters that they can relate to. They love stories. It's a great way to teach. It's a great way to learn instead of a book listing all the things you should do as a young entrepreneur.
Well, exactly, exactly. And I mean, they really love this stuff. And my sister and I have this thing where we since forever, we said, we'll never walk by a lemonade stand without buying something. Mm-hmm. And I always ask the kids when I buy things, you know, what's your revenue? What's your profit? And I get varying degrees of, you know, either answers or just completely blank stares.
Right.
I always say this is sort of the gateway into teaching your kids personal finance.
Yeah. So the book is The Startup Club, and I think it just came out. Tell us about that, where it's available.
It is available in lots of stores all across the country, or of course, you know, you can buy it online at Amazon.
But it is out now.
It is. It is indeed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, one of my heroes is, of course, Warren Buffett. And I looked it up because I knew he had jobs as a kid. So I'm going to list here a couple of jobs that he has had. And I don't think a lemonade stand was any one of them. But he delivered the Washington Post, the newspaper. And then he owned the Washington Post much later. He sold used golf balls. Now, every kid that lives on a golf course knows what that's all about.
Yeah.
He sold stamps. He buffed cars. He set up a pinball machine business. And by the age of 16, he had $56,000 saved, which in today's dollars, I didn't really do the math, but it's a heck of a lot of money for a 16-year-old to have. And as a matter of fact, there's a quote saying that he told his dad he didn't really think he needed college. Why do I need college if I can do this? So he almost skipped out on college. So, you know, obviously he turned into quite a unique individual, but how important do you think this idea of tapping into that desire? You said all kids are entrepreneurs. They all want to kind of start a business. How important is that to their future?
I personally think incredibly for two reasons. One is you have to learn about money. The earlier we learn about it, the better. The statistics of kids whose parents talk to them about money show, you know, so much more success dealing with money as they grow older. And so just using something they're already interested in, their lemonade stand or their slime business, as a way to start to teach them the value of money, how to make it, how to save it, et cetera, I think is incredibly important. But besides that, I think if you take their little business, whatever it is, and start to use the right terms for it, right? So say to them, don't just make a sign for your stand. What's your marketing, right? Give them the right terms so they think of it in the right way and start to ask them questions about pricing and why is this sign going to work better than others? Or what's your pitch to somebody? Mm-hmm. That just gets them in a mindset that will help them throughout their life, right? Being entrepreneurial is not all about starting business. It's about finding a problem and finding a way to solve it in a way that consumers or your audience wants. And so no matter if your kids work in a huge company when they're older or they start their own thing, having that skill that we can start to develop now in them is incredibly important.
Yeah, I think you'd also want to ask them the question, what would make your lemonade stand different from the one down the street, right?
Absolutely. I play this fun game with my kids also. There's an empty storefront down the street from us. And so we've played, okay, guys, what store would you put in there? And then we follow up, well, why would anyone go to it? And what should the price point be? And we ask them all these questions to dig down into whether their idea was a good one or not.
So I have to ask you this question. You keep mentioning this. What is the slime business? Is that a Nickelodeon thing?
You clearly don't have a 7, 8, or 10-year-old in your house.
Clearly not. I'm well past
so
that.
Steve, go look this up.
Okay.
Because slime, which is just a sort of thing that you play with. Kids have learned how to make it.
Okay.
With glue and some other stuff. There's literally been a run on Elmer's glue.
Well, you know, when my kids were growing up, Nickelodeon was really big and you used to get slimed. So I thought that perhaps was.
Yes.
Was that.
It is. It's that stuff. That stuff.
Okay. That disgusting stuff. Now, do your kids have businesses they're working on?
My sons have a company called American X Stress, where they make stress balls and stress paper, which makes me a little bit nervous about when I'm teaching them that they think everyone needs stress balls and stress paper.
Yeah, what's going on there?
They made a killing the other day at Take Your Kid to Work Day when they came into the makeup room at NBC and sold it all to makeup people. My daughter has a lemonade stand going on right now and a spa business where she gives massages for $1 every 5 minutes.
All right, so what is X Stress Paper?
I can't give it away.
Oh,
someone
no.
might compete with us. I'm just kidding. They take paper and they cover it with tape so that you cannot rip it.
Okay. I mean, they're actually so, scotch tape you're talking about. They're actually making paper and putting scotch tape on it. They're making their own paper. Is that it?
Oh, no.
I mean, not
just
the paper.
Taking paper
yeah.
and covering it in scotch tape and selling it. They've got a whole bunch of products. But what was fun, I have to say, a very proud moment for me with the book is I had given all of the founders, which are my sons and a few of their friends, a copy of the Startup Club early on, a manuscript. And when they were dividing up the money, I heard them refer to what the characters in the book did with
okay.
the profits. And so that was a moment for me.
I think I see a sequel coming up on this one. Second book?
I hope so.
Yeah, why not?
We put a call out to the kids who read it to come up or send in their ideas for mm-hmm. what the business is in the second book.
Great. You know, I've interviewed a number of people who, you know, are in some of the communities that really don't have a culture of mercantilism, you know, or this idea that starting a business is something that they can actually do or would even think about. I mean, if you think about, you know, who are children's role models today? Maybe it's rap stars or NBA players or baseball players. And there is this idea that, you know, what is perhaps available to them, you know, is very limited. And really the chance of being successful out of any of those that I just mentioned is pretty slight. So how important is this idea of kind of teaching this mercantilism to all children and getting this into schools and getting this to those areas that just aren't steeped in this kind of culture?
I think it is a shame that schools do not focus on this more, right? I mean, personal finance and entrepreneurship for kids, because it's really fun. It's fun for kids to think about what business could they start and then what do they do with the money and how do they save money. And there are lots of programs that are starting, but I believe it should really be part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. What I think is one neat thing is over the past, you know, decade or so, as I've been doing my show, the idea of entrepreneurship has changed in that I do believe that entrepreneurs are becoming real stars also and role models for people. And they've become kind of rock stars. And even celebrities have moved into entrepreneurship.
Yeah, that's true.
And so even kids who see these musicians, et cetera, they also hear about the businesses they started.
Right.
I think that's really neat.
Yeah. And I also think that if you are an artist, whether it be in music or otherwise, you are an entrepreneur. You own your own business. You're out there learning how to market, how to differentiate yourself.
Exactly. You're selling.
You're selling. Yep. You're playing in clubs. You're doing whatever you're doing or playing at parties. And you're bringing in money, and you've got to handle that as well. So it all goes together. My guest, J.J. Ramberg, is host of MSNBC's Your Business, which you can see weekends at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Time. And she's also co-founder of GoodShop.com, as we just mentioned. J.J., thank you so much for joining us.
This was really fun. Thank you so much.
To hear this segment again, to see a summary of it, or just to find out more about what we're doing on this show, don't forget to go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
You're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So nice to have you back.
Thank you.
Well, the housing market during the coronavirus.
Dun, 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 dun.
Are you seeing any change to your business?
You know what we're seeing? The biggest impact that we've seen is the lowering of the interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That's
pretty dramatic too.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah.
And I don't really believe people understand that this is taking place.
Yeah. Well, the news is focusing on the negative worries of the virus itself.
Correct.
And everything is in the stock market's way down and volatile as heck. And nobody's looking and thinking, you know, I have this mortgage at 3.75% or 4%, and now I can get it at 3%. I can save.
Or less.
Or less, yeah. I can save all this money, and this is going to help me out.
Oh, absolutely. It's a great time to refi. Yeah. It's an excellent time to refi. Do a cash out refi.
Yeah, you were talking about that earlier about, I think you own your house totally, right?
Right.
Taking out a mortgage.
Taking out a mortgage.
You know, the 15-year is somewhere, if you buy down with points,
right,
which I think makes sense if you're going to be in a house for a while.
Sure.
2 5/8.
Wow.
For 15 years. So if you can borrow money at 2 5/8 and then invest it in something that can throw off cash flow for you as an investment property.
It makes total sense.
And then has the potential for appreciation. Why not?
Now, don't tell too many people to do this.
I promise.
Okay? Keep it a secret.
Okay.
I'll tell you why.
Why?
Because there's no inventory. So I want to take what, you know, little nest egg I have and go buy the inventory that's out there.
I know. You realtors have the inside scoop. You're driving around neighborhoods and you go,
I want that one.
I'm coming back later. So demand for housing, the buyers are still out there and the inventory is still low. Is that the case still?
That is the case. The inventory is very low. We're down. A normal market, or is what we call a balanced market, is around 6 months worth of inventory. Mm-hmm. And on a national level, we're at like 3.1, 3.2 months of inventory. So it is really, really low. But what's also important to understand, Steve, is, you know, the sellers hear this, wow, inventory is low. Let me put my house on the market. I'm going to get a ton of money for it. Mm-hmm. There's still a market. And so you're going to sell your home for market value. You know, the buyers are pretty much the ones that determine what the value of the home is.
Yeah.
So I have examples of homes that I have for sale. We don't have any showings on them. Well,
why?
It's either condition or location.
Okay.
And one can argue that at the end of the day, it's either condition, location, or price, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't move it. So it comes down to condition or price. Well, you can always enhance the condition to match the price or adjust the price for the condition which it's currently in.
There is pressure upwards on prices because as interest rates go down, the same payment affords you a more expensive home.
That's right. An example, and we've talked about it before, if there's a 1% change in the interest rate, it'll afford you 10% more, or the other way around,
yeah,
depending on which way the interest rate went.
Yeah.
So you're looking at a 10% differential with a 1% change in interest rate.
So a $500,000 house, interest rates go in the marketplace, go down 1%, you can afford a $550,000 house. And the reverse is true as well.
That's correct. And I don't know that buyers really understand that either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when you go to get pre-approved for your finance and 6 months goes by, and you think, okay, so I can afford a $500,000 house and you're not looking over $500,000. Well, guess what? You might be able to afford a $550,000.
Right. For me, when I was looking for my home, I just knew what size mortgage I wanted and whatever that could afford me in the current interest rate environment.
Correct.
I was in, that's what I purchased.
And that's what you need.
Yeah.
That's what you really need to follow. You know, just because you qualify for a larger, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Know what that number is that you feel comfortable paying towards your housing and work the numbers backwards.
Well, the coronavirus situation is a perfect example of uncertainty.
Sure.
And you want to make sure that though you can afford this mortgage now and maybe in the foreseeable future, you want to make sure that nothing happens in your life financially. You lose a job, something happens, you know.
That's right.
You just don't know. You want to make sure that it's still something you can afford, because really the last thing in the world you want to be worried about is the house or the roof over your head.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have a nest egg.
All right. So you are making the point that price matters, and you have listings where people are overpricing their homes and they're not selling.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then homes that are priced right and truly priced right, you get multiple offers and they sell real fast.
So it's a good time to sell, of course.
Sure. It's always a good time to sell. When's the best time to sell, Steve?
Look who I'm asking, right? When's the best time to sell?
Absolutely right now.
And when's the best time to buy?
Absolutely right now. Now, let me explain why this time.
Okay.
Because it's maybe different than what I'll tell you next week. We're coming into the spring season, right? Mm-hmm. And we know that inventory levels are low. We know that historically, there's an uptick of inventory the closer we get to school coming out. So why not get ahead of the curve and have your home on the market now?
Plus, literally, between December and January of this year,
right,
you know, less than this year, housing starts have increased over 9%.
That's right.
The developers are not deaf. They know that there's
a shortage,
opportunity out
an
there
opportunity
for them. And they're going to be building into that opportunity.
That's right.
So housing prices may soften. Maybe the economy is going to soften. So right. I, for once, will agree that this is probably a very good time, if you're going to sell, is to really get your house on the market and get her done.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of people say, you know, think about it this way. If you're a seller, we know that we're at the top of the market. I mean, we've been in a rising market since 2011. Mm-hmm. It's not going to go up forever and ever, right?
Yeah.
So if we believe we're at the top of the market, all you're really doing is transferring your equity from one home to another. So if you are a seller, you're selling high. Now you're buying high.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's all about the cost of purchase. So your cost of purchase is that interest rate. And with the interest rate being low, you're really making up the difference.
Okay. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
There's little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times, the daily drumbeat of news and opinion revolving around the unforeseen impact of the coronavirus is enough to make your head spin. When you add in today's considerable market ups and downs, compounded by the upcoming election season, and all the seeming uncertainty, it could add more stress and uneasiness to your lives. So I'm offering all of you, my wonderful listeners, a market call just for you. Just go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up, and if you like, you can write in any questions you may have, which I'll do my very best to answer during the call. Here's a few ways to hear my broadcast. You can call and listen in from anywhere, or just log in and listen from your computer, and no fear, we'll make it very easy for you to join the conversation. You know, I always say my mission is to protect and educate you, and that's exactly what I'll be doing on April 9th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. That's Thursday, April 9th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll talk about what you can do if the markets keep going down or stay down. I'll discuss ways to increase your income in the meantime from your investments and savings. I'll show you ways to boost your return on savings, increase your cash flow, reduce your taxes, and more. You see, I want to make sure you're living your one best financial life and help you get the information you need to get it right. Plus, I'll describe some of the tools you can use to get yourself on track and help you stay there. So go to stevepomerantz.com, write in with any questions you'd like me to answer, and reserve your spot for Thursday, April 9th at 12 noon. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. Carmine Gallo is the two-time Wall Street Journal best-selling author of the book Talk Like TED, and in that he's referring to the great TED Talks that can be viewed on YouTube and other outlets and so on. He's also a columnist for Forbes.com and Entrepreneur.com, and today we're going to delve into his new book, The Storyteller's Secret. From TED speakers to business legends, why some ideas catch on and others don't. So, Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
So, this whole idea of trying to convince somebody of your point of view, whether it's to sell a product or to get them to do something that you know is in their best interest, having facts on your side just isn't enough. You have to do storytelling. I guess it's part of our collective DNA, you know, the epical image of our ancestors sitting around a fire, electrified by a wonderful storyteller, is something we can all understand. Has storytelling changed after all of these many millennia?
The tools have changed. We use PowerPoint instead of painting pictures on cave walls. But it's exactly right, what you said. It's in our DNA. So what was fascinating and fun for me to write A Storyteller's Secret is to get into the science and to speak to neuroscientists who have studied this, and anthropologists who say that storytelling goes back 400,000 years. When people were able to sit around a campfire and tell stories, that is the milestone in human development because it sparked our imagination. Well, I realize that we're doing the same thing today. Things haven't changed. Richard Branson, who I've interviewed a couple of times, gathers his team around a campfire at his home on Necker Island, and they specifically do so for the purpose of sharing stories. And in fact, he said, not too long ago, Richard Branson said that if you want to be a successful entrepreneur, you'd better have a good idea, and you'd better be a great storyteller.
Yeah. So I can imagine Richard Branson on one of his islands sitting around a campfire, but I have a feeling that campfire is something digital or different. Is it?
There's actually, he commissioned a local artist to create the most beautiful fire pit you've ever seen. So okay. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I knew it had to be something like that. What does the science say, which proves our basic human response to storytelling?
Well, this is the most fascinating part. We now have more evidence in the last 10 years that story is the most effective component of persuasion. We've learned more in the last 10 years than we've ever known. Because we have MRI, we have lab tests, we have data now. So we're learning several things. They're doing research at Princeton University where they are finding that when two people tell each other a story, the brains of both the speaker and the listener are in sync. It's called neural coupling, which means that if I tell you a story, they can see the same regions of our brain having that same blood flow. They call it neural coupling. I call it having a brain sync. You know, I mean, we're just in sync with each other. Paul Zak on the other end of the coast in Orange County, California, or in Los Angeles, is studying oxytocin. And I've had a couple of conversations with Dr. Zak. So what he finds is that when you are watching a gripping or heart-wrenching story, that when they take a blood draw, there's a much higher level of the molecule oxytocin, which is the love molecule, which creates empathy between two people. And they are finding that a higher level of oxytocin is more likely to incite someone or persuade someone to give money to a charity. So in other words, when we hear stories, it's doing something to our brain. It is triggering a rush of chemicals, cortisol, dopamine, and oxytocin. So stories actually do work on our brain. And that's because, getting back to what we just talked about, Steve, we're hardwired for story. This is the way we process information.
Well, we live in an age which is increasingly being dominated by robots and automation. And I guess the question is storytelling a purely human endeavor? Can it be replicated automatically or autonomously through robots, or is that going to be the great differentiator?
Well, this is why I'm excited about the topic, because I started writing about storytelling just strictly from a business perspective, because venture capitalists, billionaires like Richard Branson, VCs, great leaders, they were all telling me the same thing. They were all telling me, Carmine, if you speak to entrepreneurs or small business owners or business professionals, please tell them that facts alone are not enough. They're not doing storytelling. They have to wrap their data in narrative and emotion and story. So this was, for me, a pure play business book. Till I started to realize, and I read a lot of material on this subject, that computers and automation are replacing almost every human task. And it's quite frightening, because there are tasks which just a few years ago we didn't think would ever be automated, more creative tasks. So it is frightening, and it's displacing jobs, but there is one skill that so far, at least, and in the foreseeable future, robots cannot replicate, and that's the human power of emotion through story.
I see.
So to me, now it becomes an even bigger ultimate competitive advantage, not just in business, but in life.
Saying that the emotional aspect of the human condition is something that is maybe the fundamental differentiator between us and robots.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be your ultimate competitive advantage, so you remain relevant in the workplace.
Very good point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not too long ago, I mean, just real quickly.
Sure.
I spoke to a young 25-year-old man who had some technical experience. He was looking for a new job. He had some technical experience, but not much. And so on paper, he didn't look that good compared to a lot of other candidates. But in his first job interview, he said he had read some of my work and really practiced communicating what that company's vision was and their products and all that. They hired him in 2 days. He doubled his salary.
Yeah.
And they told him specifically, they said, we have plenty of people who know the technical part, but not that many who can communicate it well.
My guest is Carmine Gallo. The book is The Storyteller's Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. And to find out more about Carmine and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation. And I say this very emotionally, join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org. So we all know one archetypal typical story is the rags to riches storyline. What are some of the other archetypical stories that we're very, very familiar with?
Well, first of all, rags to riches, keep telling them. We are wired. Here's something else in this literature. We are wired to love rags to riches stories because we need to hear them. We need to find meaning in struggle. So if you have struggled or you have failed and learned something from it, by all means, continue to share those personal stories because they make a connection with people.
Mm-hmm.
But the other structure that I like is by stealing a page from Hollywood. All commercially successful movies have a three-part structure, and you can use this in your very next business pitch or presentation.
What are they?
Part one is the setup. So there has to be the backstory, the status quo. Here is the hero's world as it is. Part two is the conflict. That's where we get the villain. And part three is the resolution. Every movie, almost every commercially successful movie, has to follow the three parts. In a business pitch, Steve, it's very simple. So let's say you are advising someone or a new client or a prospect, paint a picture of the world as it is for that particular company or client. Act two, there's a problem or a challenge. You know, they're about to hit an iceberg in Titanic. They may not even see the iceberg, but you're going to show them that conflict. Part three is the resolution, and that is how your business, your idea, your service is going to make their world a better place.
Yeah.
Three structures, you could do that in 1 minute, 1 minute story.
You know, the one story that comes to mind when you describe this is basically the story of Cinderella, which is, I understand, is told in many cultures, the backstory, you know, the poor young girl and the backstory about the evil sisters. And so there's your villains. And then, of course, you know, the rise to final fame and fortune and so on.
A screenwriter taught me that Cinderella and Rocky, those movies work because there is a very strong dramatic arc.
Yeah.
So they can't just be not doing well. Mm-hmm. They have to be really down in the dumps.
Yeah.
And then they have to be at a castle at the end. I mean, there has to be a big dramatic arc.
There's a great Kurt Vonnegut video, YouTube. It's on YouTube. He was lecturing, I don't know, must have been 34 more years ago on a blackboard. And he discusses just that, the exact arc of Cinderella. I'm going to send it to you. You're going to love it. What level of language in business or otherwise should you be using? Should you be speaking at a college level, at a high school level, or what's the best level of language to use?
Well, I hope we don't offend anybody on our radio station today. Sixth grade level.
Sixth grade.
Okay. And I do have a lot of proof for this. But let me add this caveat. When, and this is actually an important caveat, when you have a message that needs to be communicated to the widest possible group of people, it helps to speak in sixth grade language. Sixth grade language meaning a typical sixth grader can probably understand and read it, and that the words are short. The sentence structure is very simple. There isn't a lot of jargon. It's not very confusing, just very simply laid out.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of evidence for this. Bill Gates, in his newsletter, every year Bill Gates sends out this beautiful newsletter that talks about philanthropy in the world and some of the challenges that he and Melinda Gates see. Take a look at the last newsletter. I took all of the content from it. I put it into a tool that actually measures text for grade appropriate levels. And it turned out to be about sixth grade. So what Bill Gates has done beautifully is he is learning to take complex information and reduce it to a very simple language.
Yeah.
We're seeing this a lot. Steve Jobs did this all the time. Elon Musk. I have a whole chapter on Elon Musk. I took an entire presentation of his that, again, meant for the masses, not just two engineers, meant for the masses. And it's about sixth grade level. And he would say things like, this is real. Pollution is real.
Yeah.
Our air is dirty.
Yeah,
this is the answer. This is the solution. It is called the sun. Mm-hmm. Very simple language.
Right, right. Now, I just saw on YouTube him rolling out the battery for the home. And that's exactly the terminology he used. We have this big fireball in the sky that gives us unlimited energy, right? We can all see that image.
That's exactly right. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you interviewed, I think, 50 storytellers, and it was quite a range. And you mentioned Richard Branson, but you've also interviewed or you write about Howard Schwartz from Starbucks, but even Joel Osteen, the incredibly successful televangelist. What's different? What's the same about those very three vastly different characters and other characters that you've written about? And what's really the same?
Well, the first third of the book, and this is, again, I did not intend for this to happen, but the first third of the book talks about how you need to reframe the message or the story you tell yourself. You will never inspire others unless you're inspired yourself, unless you actually believe and have confidence that your story is worth being heard and shared. So Joel Osteen, this is not a religious book in any way, but Joel Osteen obviously is a very successful motivational speaker. For 17 years, he did not believe that he belonged on stage. And today he sells out Yankee Stadium. Mm-hmm. He sells out stadiums around the world. Can you imagine how nervous most people would be speaking to 50,000 people? And yet, 17 years ago, or for 17 years, he never saw himself doing that. And the first time he preached, Joel Osteen told me that he was absolutely paralyzed with fear. Mm-hmm. He was shaking at the lectern.
I know a lot of people can relate to that for sure.
Yeah.
Now, his father was a pastor.
It starts with changing your internal thought structure, speaking differently to yourself.
Yeah.
It all starts in your head.
Well, is it the Stuart Smiley thing, like from the old SNL, you know, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me? Or is it something a little bit more sophisticated than that?
It's not that much more sophisticated. You know, visualization. I mean, we know from great athletes, great winners, that they visualize
themselves. Yeah, they visualize, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So you have to visualize. If you have a fear of public speaking, you absolutely have to go through the motions and visualize yourself as a strong speaker. Shonda Rhimes, the Grey's Anatomy producer, was paralyzed with fear of public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote a book called The Year of Yes. You may have heard of it. The Year of Saying Yes, where she actually accepted opportunities that she never would have accepted before. Yeah. She had to say yes to everything. And she realized that she became more confident by doing those things which she originally feared. Now she embraces
it. I hadn't heard that, but I actually have gone through my own personal experience with a period of saying yes to things I had formerly said no to. So that's quite interesting for me. We have interviewed Barbara Corcoran, which is one of the people in the book, but you mentioned an individual by the name of Brian Stevenson, not a household name by any imagination. He's a TED speaker. Tell us quickly about him.
Brian Stevenson is a human rights attorney. He earned the longest standing ovation of any TED speaker in TED's 30-year history. So look him up, Brian Stevenson. He is a very successful attorney who wins cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. So he knows how to persuade. If you watch a 15-minute presentation by Stevenson, there's three personal stories. So what he does is he tells a personal story, then he delivers the data that he intends to communicate to his audience. Personal story, data, personal story, data. So there's three stories. The data reinforce the story, but the data doesn't come first. Whereas in most business presentations, what do we all do? It's all just a data dump,
yeah.
But there's no emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Stevenson knows, and he has told me, that narrative is hugely important in persuasion.
Personal story, data, personal story. People relate to who you are and the struggles you've dealt with in your life, and that's the way to kind of to start setting up the image that you're trying to portray.
Or in business or business pitch, it could be a case study.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're an investment advisor. It can be, obviously, you have a million case studies of people who did something or who did not take a plan of action and may have suffered because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So those are equally as powerful as personal stories.
Very interesting. The book is The Storyteller's Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. My guest is Carmine Gallo, the author. And to find out more about Carmine and to hear this interview again, and get the transcripts for this interview as well, join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. www.carmineandbrock.com. Carmine, it was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times, the daily drumbeat of news and opinion revolving around the unforeseen impact of the coronavirus is enough to make your head spin. When you add in today's considerable market ups and downs, compounded by the upcoming election season, and all the seeming uncertainty, it could add more stress and uneasiness to your lives. So, I'm offering all of you, my wonderful listeners, a market call just for you. Just go to stevepomerantz.com to sign up, and if you like, you can write in any questions you may have, which I'll do my very best to answer during the call. Here's a few ways to hear my broadcast. You can call and listen in from anywhere, or just log in and listen from your computer, and no fear, we'll make it very easy for you to join the conversation. You know, I always say my mission is to protect and educate you, and that's exactly what I'll be doing on April 9th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. That's Thursday, April 9th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll talk about what you can do if the markets keep going down or stay down. I'll discuss ways to increase your income in the meantime from your investments and savings. I'll show you ways to boost your return on savings, increase your cash flow, reduce your taxes, and more. You see, I want to make sure you're living your one best financial life and help you get the information you need to get it right. Plus, I'll describe some of the tools you can use to get yourself on track and help you stay there. So go to stevepomerantz.com, write in with any questions you'd like me to answer, and reserve your spot for Thursday, April 9th at 12 noon. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.